The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Summer is over, but don't despair. The new Book Awards season is about to begin. And first up is the Guardian First Book Award, now in its 13th year. We reveal who's made it onto the long list, and we speak to the writer, Juan Pablo Villalobos, about his novel, Down the Rabbit Hole, which, in a brand new initiative this year, was our reader's nomination for the 10th title on the list. And then, Francisco Goldman tells us about Say Her Name, his novel concerning the death of his young wife.
And we start with the Guardian First Book Prize. With me in the studio is Lisa Allardyce, who chairs the award and has just finished the Herculean task of compiling the long list. Lisa, would you begin by running us through the 10 titles? There are four non-fiction books here, aren't there?
Hello, yes, it was indeed a Herculean task. I think we had something like 138 submissions in all. This year, for the first time, it wasn't a case of coming up with a long list of 10, but rather a long list of 9, because the 10th book was opened out to readers. And so it was done on the internet with readers suggesting books to be submitted that hadn't been submitted yet by the publishers. So in fact, we were looking for 9 titles, and we, as you say, we came up with 4 non-fiction. The first is The Possessed by Eilif Batchman. I mean, Eilif has got such a strong individual voice, which is something you're always looking for in a writer at all, and a first writer especially. I mean, she's written fantastic pieces for The New Yorker, and she's a journalist. And this is a sort of quasi-memoir of her love affair with Russian literature and terrible language exchange programmes. And it's very quirky and completely captivating.
Now, the second one is Owen Jones's Chavs. And this, I'm very interested in this. He's been getting a lot of airtime because, of course, it's incredibly topical suddenly, which you can't have known when you were doing the selection process.
Yes, it is. It's the subtitle is The Demonization of the Working Class, and it's a sort of a look at the anatomy of the British class system from Thatcherism to the BNP. And yeah, he's an incredibly young writer, and it's very assured, and it's a very audacious subject. It's great to have it on the list.
And especially since the riots. Suddenly Completely. Everybody's looking in a different way at it. Now, what about The Emperor of Maladies by Siddhartha Mukherjee? This is a biography of cancer, which sounds a very strange sort of thing to attempt.
This sort of divided us on the desk as far as there are those of us who'd rather eat our own arms with a spoon than read anything about illness. And I'm definitely in the squeamish camp. But even somebody like me who will flick over pages of a newspaper when it says anything about illness at all, this is so compelling. It is so good. He treats cancer as a biography. I don't think there's been a non-fiction book this year that has had such comprehensively positive reviews. It's an impressive work of scholarship, and it is very unique and very engaging on a human level.
And Siddhartha Mukherjee, the author, won a Pulitzer for it, didn't
he? Yeah, it did. As I say, it has garnered lots of attention, and it is a really impressive achievement.
Okay, well, let's move now to fiction, which in some ways is always absolutely the heart of the long list, even if the eventual winner turns out not to be. Very interesting collection of books here.
I did think it was a particularly strong year for fiction. I mean, we tried very hard to make sure that all the books on the list were something that either I or somebody else on the books or review team really loved. So we didn't worry too much about making sure that all genres were represented. They had to be books that somebody was really championing very strongly. So just to run through them, another timely book is Pidgin in English by Stephen Kelman, which is on the Booker long list. This is an incredibly captivating, charming book narrated by an 11-year-old Ghanaian boy. It's loosely based, I think, on the Damilola Taylor case. And it's terribly sad and very heartfelt.
Looking at urban gang culture and knife crime and really difficult
subject. It's black gang culture set in an estate in Peckham. And even though it is incredibly sad and very grueling, it is very witty and very engaging. The voice, again, is very strong and captivating. A particular favourite of mine is the submission by Amy Waldman. I like this because it is so audacious, not only in terms of its subject matter, but also in terms of its structure. She eschews the sort of first person narrator all the way through and changes her point of view often. It's set in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. So again, with the anniversary, the 10th anniversary of 9/11 approaching, it's very topical. The sort of situation is a prize to create a memorial on Ground Zero, and it's an unnamed prize. It's an anonymous prize, I should say. And the panel are shocked when they discover that it is, in fact, a Muslim who has submitted his entry, and it's the fallout from that. And it's an incredibly sensitive, clever, sophisticated novel.
Now, in terms of topicality, Mirza Wahid's The Collaborator is right up there as well, isn't it?
It is, even though it is in fact set in the Kashmiri Wars of the early 1990s, it is about the Indian-Pakistan border and this sort of unreported war. It's a devastating work of fiction.
What was interesting for me was that Wahid is a journalist, but he's chosen to fictionalise this because actually journalists can't go into this region of Pakistan now, can they?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this was a revelatory book for me. And again, the voice is very strong. I hope that this means that lots more people will read it.
So
what we've got left is The Night Circus by a young American writer called Erin Morgenstern, which is sort of Angela Carter-ish. It's very magical. It's a late 19th century sort of almost period drama. I mean, the book itself is a work of art. It's very beautiful. It's got this thing which seems to be very fashionable in publishing at the moment, which I'm not entirely convinced by, to tint the sides of the book pages, and they're all black. But it's an incredibly sort of baroque-looking artifact itself, and it's about two star-crossed lovers in a circus, and it's very magical. It is already getting huge amounts of excitement and publicity behind it. And then another one that really took me by surprise at a point where I thought I'd be sick if I opened another book, and I just had to keep on reading it. It might not sound as captivating as in fact it is. It's set on Guernsey, and it's two voices. It's called The Book of Lies, and it's by Mary Horlock. It's narrated by a teenage girl, and it looks back to the Nazi occupation of Guernsey. And it's absolutely fascinating. It's very original. And again, it has a completely strong and very unique narrative voice.
Now, the final novel is Down the Rabbit Hole, which we'll come to a bit later, but there is also a poetry collection.
Yes, of course. And I'm not sure if I'm going to pronounce this right. Sidereal by a young British poet called Rachel Boast. It's all about stars and galaxies and astronomy and time. There are reflections on Coleridge. It's fantastically confident and sparkling and altogether lovely.
Lisa, thanks very much for coming in. You can go and have a well-deserved reading break now. Now, as we just mentioned, the 10th book on the first book long list is nominated by you, our readers and listeners. And this year it's gone to a new publisher, And Other Stories. The book is Down the Rabbit Hole, and it's by the Mexican writer Juan Pablo Villalobos. It tells the story of Tochtli, the son of a Mexican drug baron who's growing up in a luxury hideout surrounded by guns, hitmen and dealers. Adam Thirlwell, in his introduction to the book, described it as a miniature high-speed experiment with perspective, a deliberate wild attack on the conventions of literature. And since the book was nominated by readers, we sent Villalobos along to face questions from the reading group at the Edinburgh Bookshop. His translator, Rosalind Harvey, was there too. She was instrumental in getting the book published in English and started by explaining why she was so keen for it to find a wider audience.
I mean, it's a wonderful story. In a way, you learn something about Mexico, but the most striking thing about it for me was the voice of Tochtli, the little boy narrator. It's just so insistent. He's in many ways a very unusual little boy. He's growing up in an environment which is very far removed from what most English readers and most Mexican readers, to be honest, will be familiar with. But I finished reading the book and I could still hear his little voice in my head. It's so insistent. I couldn't let it go.
The thing I found most moving about this book was Tochtli. I found his innocence heartbreaking, but I also found his humour quite amusing. My question throughout this was, how did you come up with him? Where did you find him?
Encontrar la voz de Tochtli tuvo algo de magia.
He said there was something magical about how he found the voice of Tochtli. And he was working on it for quite a long time when he suddenly just came up with the first sentence of the book, which in English is, "Some people say I'm precocious." He felt that contained within that sentence was the tone for the whole book, so all of Tochtli's personality was in that phrase, and it just felt right.
As a book artist, I really enjoyed all your references to books, and I wondered if you see them as a redeeming force.
Sí, en lo importante en la novela es que hay un enfrentamiento entre la cultura libresca.
So in the book there's a clash between the culture of books and the culture of experience. He felt it was interesting to highlight something in Mexico which is a sort of rejection of the culture of books. So Tochtli has a sort of struggle between these two cultures. He's obviously a man of books, a man of letters, and he thought it was interesting to show this sort of damaging hatred, as it were, towards the culture of books.
As it was written from a child's perspective, it seemed almost as important to miss things out of what was said and what was mentioned in the book. But one of the most important things missing seemed to be a mother figure. Was this deliberate so you could concentrate on just the male figures in his life, or is there a backstory that perhaps you were going to develop?
Es una pregunta muy, muy interesante. Es deliberado el que no.
So
que
it
no
was deliberate. And it's an interesting question, and the fact also that all the other female characters are just sort of utilitarian, so there's a prostitute, there's a cleaner, a cook. It's a kind of provocative decision to call into question the role of the woman in Mexican society, where she's just sort of played a role as a housewife and just serving other people's needs.
En función de resolver los problemas de la familia.
I was just wondering how accurate some of the setting was in terms of, you know, the drug lord living in this sort of almost like a kind of compound away from everybody else. How did you do your research, and how close is some of it to reality in Mexico?
No hice una investigación en términos periodísticos.
He didn't do a kind of journalistic set of research to do with the world of drugs exactly. Unfortunately, there's really no way that you can fail when you write in this way, because it's in Mexicans' collective consciousness. People feel that they know how these people live.
How the story ends with Tochtli getting what he wants, albeit in quite a, I suppose, a sordid way, I really worry for his future now, and I'm wondering if you know how things are going to be for him.
Es una pregunta que me repiten mucho.
He's not determinist about it, and he doesn't think it's necessarily the case that Tochtli will end up being like his father. You could say that in one sense nothing actually happens in the novel. So the bad guys just get what they want. He gets what he wants, but he gets a sort of stuffed, dried version of what he wants.
La realidad le llega muerta, ¿no?
That was the reading group at the Edinburgh Bookshop talking to Juan Pablo Villalobos and Rosalind Harvey. Down the Rabbit Hole is handsomely published by And Other Stories. I wonder what our Waterstones reading groups will make of it. Over the next 10 weeks, they'll be whittling down the long list to a short list of 5. The winner of the first book award will be announced in early December. And the theme of Mexico continues with a new book from the American writer Francisca Goldman. His young wife, Ara Estrada, was just 30 when she died in a freak accident while body surfing on the coast of Mexico in 2007. Goldman, her husband of almost 2 years, was with her at the time. This tragedy haunts every page of his latest book, as Zan Brooks found out when he met Goldman at the Edinburgh International Book Festival.
Frank, I think it's safe to assume that people are going to read Say Her Name as this great act of emburdening, this forensic account of the grieving process, this howl of loss, and completely factual. And yet you've described the book as a novel. How so?
To understand that, you have to go back to when I began it, right? 6 months after Ada's death, and I began it with no... without any ambitions to really publish it. I wasn't thinking about that. I just started writing, because it's just the way I process things. I process things myself by turning them into fictions, turning them into stories, even though they're very true. So something that's not in the book now, but was there at the very beginning, I felt, well, I'm under this accusation that I was somehow responsible. In some ways, this accusation imprisons me. I'm going to pretend this is being narrated from prison. You know, so fiction was there from the very beginning. Later I decided that was too cumbersome, it didn't work, and I took it out. I also thought that from the very beginning, the last third of the novel, my narration would suddenly disappear into Auda's novel, and I would sort of be trying to complete her novel for her. And again, it didn't work out quite that way, but if you read the book, you know that's still there. In a way, at the very end of the book, he does step into her novel. So the freedom with which I wrote the book was there from the very beginning. So to me, it was always going to be a novel, as true as everything about Aura and us. I mean, here you get into the whole question, I think, of, you know, the ethics of the imagination, right? What would a person in my position make up And what wouldn't they? I think anybody who is a sensitive reader could answer that. You know, it's like, why would I make up anything without her? For one thing, I wouldn't get away with it. She has family, she has friends. If I were to say that she had done something radically different from what she did, I'd be denounced all over the place. So where would I invent? Well, where a lot of fiction writing happens is in the depiction of the facts of the grief life. I was trying to get to the emotional truth of what that was like, and also get rid of anything that might stand between the reader and my depiction of that. So the last thing, finally, is I had a lot of identities to protect, especially in the grieving process. You know, there's a period of promiscuity there. There's family members you need to depict. And, you know, all of that, I didn't want this to be a romantic cleft. I didn't want it to be where somebody can say, I can figure out who that is. I mean, I really had to completely fictionalize those encounters. So at that point, to me anyway, you can't call it nonfiction.
You're kind of riding two horses here as well. On the one hand, you're honouring your wife and trying to represent her as well as you can and as accurately as you can. But on the other hand, you're writing. So you're trying to construct a drama and to tell a story. And that's a very ruthless, take no prisoners discipline, isn't it? So you almost have to kind of misrepresent in order, in the service of drama, don't you?
Yeah.
That must
have
been difficult.
It's always difficult. How's that great Milosh poem essay ends with how the river suffers because the reflections of the cloud and trees on the surface of the river are not the actual clouds and trees. And so there's always that sense of frustration. Sure, it's just, you know, a thing you were making. And it's not in any way a replacement, you know, for the person herself. But I think, too, Aura was an incredibly gifted writer. Her DNA was made of literature. No one I've ever met in my life loved literature so much. Maybe someone like Comte Bin, you know? And she was like that. I just felt I had to make something for her that she would like, which for her would not be a straight memoir. She would find that really boring. You know, I had to try to make a kind of beautiful, surprising thing for her. And, you know, to what degree I succeeded, you know, other people can decide, but that was what I was trying to do.
In writing the book, you've brought her close and I guess given her a kind of life again. But how is it now on the circuit when you're kind of promoting the book, when you're selling the book? Does that risk turning Aura into, you know, this precious memory into a commodity that you're hawking, like at stalls? Is that a strange experience for you?
At first I was terrified of that experience, but I think you put your finger right on it when you said gave out our life. Because finally, what's important about a book is not what I say on a book tour. It's how readers engage with the book. And one nice thing about a book tour is you meet a lot of readers. And usually the people who come out to hear you are people who have liked the book, not people who have hated the book, you know. And in your life, you know that it's impolite and boring to always be talking about Aura. Your friends don't want you. You have to discipline yourself to not do it anymore. And of course, talking about Aura is really still my favorite thing to do. So when I got out and book tour, and suddenly I realized I have permission. Not only do I have permission, I'm supposed to. You know, there was a kind of sugar rush in that, a kind of high in that. And then, of course, at night, I'd go back to the hotel room, and I'd feel very sad. But as I got going on the tour, I began to realize that this really remarkable thing was happening, that if kind of a stated ambition of the book, you know, was to fight against the threat that memory and memory loss represents, that might, you know, somehow write something so that Aura wouldn't be forgotten. I realized that was happening. People were really, you know, digging her. People were really liking her. People had this living idea of her out there, you know.
Tell me about the other family in the book. I mean, the great drama and the tension in the book is your relationship with Juanita, with Aura's mother, who blames you for her death.
Yeah.
Presumably, she hasn't made any public comment on this book, but do you know she's read it? Do you know what her kind of reaction is?
No, she doesn't read English. I don't have contact with her. I hear things. I don't think she'd be interested in reading it, but I think maybe once some years have passed and the book isn't news anymore. Everyone reacts in their grief in a different way, and it does madden people. But what was essential, really all that mattered, was to portray the love that Aura and she had for each other. As difficult as it could sometimes be, that had to be really present, because you can't love Aura or claim to love Aura without really understanding the role her mother played in her life. And that was what I tried to, because I wasn't there in their childhood and so forth. That was the hardest, most challenging part of that book to write.
What would she say about this book?
Well, she'd be very bashful, you know. She'd never, I mean, I know this, all her friends love it, right? All her friends are, that is Aura. You know, every last one of her closest friends, even the boyfriend, the Mexican writer boyfriend that she had when I met her, even he wrote to me and said, I didn't believe in resurrection until I read the book. He goes, so I think that among those of us who loved Aura and are left here on Earth, they love it. What would she have liked? She would have liked that people realized, as they say in Mexican, what a chingona she was, you know, what a like brilliant, talented, unforgettable, funny woman she was. And I think that you do get the feeling, if you read the book, that she would have gone on to have a marvelous literary career. I really think she would have. Of course, there's lots of things she wouldn't have liked, so what can you do?
Frank Goldman, it's an extraordinary piece of writing, and I'm very sorry that you had to write it, but I'm very glad to have read it. So thanks for speaking to us today.
Francisco Goldman talking to Zan Brooks. Say Her Name is published by Grove Atlantic. Join us next week to hear all about the Booker Prize shortlist. Meanwhile, Guardian Review on Saturday features Pankaj Mishra on the big books marking the 10th anniversary of 9/11. In the Observer New Review, there's also Peter Conrad reviewing A.S. Byatt's Ragnarok and Robert McCrum on the Chambers Dictionary. But for now, thanks to Francisco Goldman, Lisa Allardyce and Zan Brooks. Special thanks to the Edinburgh Bookshop Reading Group for their great questions to Juan Pablo Villalobos and Rosalind Harvey. I'm Claire Armistead and the producer was Ian Chambers. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.